Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello. Welcome to another moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And ladies and gentlemen, this is not going to be a hot mic episode. Yay! So the plan is to have some more guests coming back in a regular rotation and stuff. And I really want to thank people for being patient. There have been some people that have wanted to come on, and I kind of told them I needed to get some things adjusted. I'm still going through adjustment phase, but there were some people that persisted and got through. And one of them is a young lady named Kim Moffitt. So let me go ahead and introduce Kim, because I think she brings an interesting perspective as somebody who came into the process because of the events that were happening in the country and became fully invested in the process. So let me just give you her intro, and then you'll understand why I'm saying what I'm saying. Kim is the founder and executive director of We Are Voters, which began as a documentary, We're the People, focused on the 2014 gubernatorial race in Texas. After spending 4 years following both the 2014 and 2016 elections and speaking to eligible voters around the country, she founded an organization to increase voter turnout through civics education. In addition to her work in civics education, she had a decade of experience in television production. Shows like Heart of Dixie, Fuller House, Veronica Mars, Grey's Anatomy, and This Is Us. She is also a prominent podcaster, including a daily news podcast show called Here's What's Happening. She holds a bachelor's degree in television and film production and a master's degree in political science. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor and privilege to bring to you as a guest on A Moment with Eric Fleming, Miss Kim Moffitt. All right, Kim Moffitt, how are you doing? You doing good?
I'm doing excellent. How are you doing?
I'm doing lovely. It's been a minute since I've been able to have a guest. I've been doing a lot of rearranging and running around, so I'm glad that I was able to get you on. Some of the work that you're doing, I wanted to highlight it on this particular podcast. So, again, it's an honor to have you on.
Well, I really appreciate it. I'm really excited to be here. So,
yes, ma'am. All right, so when I do have guests on, I try to, if I can, find a quote either related to the work they're doing or something that they've either written or said, right? So your quote comes from this gentleman named Thomas Jefferson.
I'm familiar with his work.
Okay.
I've heard of him.
Whenever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government. That whenever things get so far wrong as to attract their notice, they may be relied on to set them to rights. What does that quote mean to you?
Well, you know, I had two thoughts about it. First of all, hearing a white man in 1789, say, you know, whenever people know about their government, then they can be a part of it. My mind immediately is like, well, but you're setting up a system that is going to specifically exclude people from knowing about their government and being a part of it. So it's thinking about it in the context of 1789, it's a little rich for me. I kind of have to chuckle at it. But, you know, overall, it is important for us as engaged citizens of this country, and it is important for our leaders to make sure that we all are aware of what is going on. And that we, as we become aware, we take, you know, matters into our own hand by voting, by making sure that we are paying attention to the news and everything that is happening, that we're thoughtful in our responses. But I don't think, you know, it's not like we can just allow our leaders and electeds to be in charge of who gets to know what's happening. And only once you know, then can you, once they feel like we're educated enough, can we be a part of it? We have to be a part of it no matter what. We're seeing that happen right now. We're seeing a lot of leaders try and say, like, you don't need to know about everything that's happening, and try and push people out of being engaged citizens.
Yeah, I appreciate the historical reference as to the time when he said that, right? Because, one, not everybody was recognized as being citizens or even men, right? And so, you know, but the importance to me of that quote is that there has to be some sort of political efficacy, right? I think that people need to have enough knowledge to be able to read between the lines and sift through. What I see happening in America is that we've had too many politicians on both sides push for the lowest common denominator, right? On the liberal side, it's this unrealistic hope. And on the conservative side is this dystopian fear, right? And it gets, you know, it's playing on endorphins instead of intelligence, to me. And so I think that people that, you know, need to have a balance and understand that not everything is that bad, but not every, you know, things that you may want are not going to come immediately as soon as you push that button or that person gets sworn in. So I think there needs to be some level of education in that point. Like I said, you don't have to be a political junkie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I do think that people need to have a basic understanding so they can have realistic expectations. You feel what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's kind of the basis for a lot of our programming at We Are Voters. Is you don't need to be, I spend my whole day, every day, very, very deep in politics through the work that I'm doing at We Are Voters. And also just because it's something that I'm genuinely very interested in. It's, you know, my whole passion, right? So I'm very focused on it. I don't need everybody to, you know, be a nerd about this kind of stuff. People should have hobbies. They should be fun at a party, unlike me. But, you know, they've got to know the basics, right? And it's also, we always say, like, we want to lower the barrier of entry into politics. But there's nothing embarrassing about saying, hey, I don't know this yet.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And speaking of which, now, based on your intro, your background wasn't exactly in politics. So my question for you is, how did a Hollywood insider like you, right, become an activist for voter registration? What really got you going?
Yeah. It's funny. That is true. It's not like a very common entryway into civics education, right? So my undergrad is in film production. I moved to LA. This is all I ever wanted to do my entire life, was move to Hollywood and somehow work in the industry in some way. And so I got my undergrad in film production, moved up here to Los Angeles. The second show that I was on was like a dream scenario of a show. It was a cast that I was a really big fan of. The showrunner, I was a huge fan of the showrunner. I was so excited about this show. I'd just been hired on it, and I was going to start in like 2 weeks in June. And in that time period, in that break between shows, I had gone down to my parents' house. I was just kind of hanging out at the house on Twitter, as you know, I am wont to do most times. And I see on Twitter that there is a filibuster happening in Texas. I'm in California. I've never lived in Texas. I have a great affinity for the state, but that's really it. But now suddenly it's June 25th, 2013, and I am watching on YouTube as Wendy Davis does a 13-hour filibuster in Texas. And I don't know what it was. I always say that we don't always know what's going to wake us up and when we're going to need it. But I watched that whole, almost a whole filibuster on YouTube that day. And something about watching her stand up for the rights of not only people in Texas, but really all over the country, like, lit a fire in me. And then when she announced that she would be running for governor, I was like, okay, this is it. All I'm going to do is go out to Texas, make a documentary about her. Somehow in between like prepping for that documentary and actually getting out there, it kind of snowballed into, now I want to help. I want her to win. I want to see if we can turn out voters. And while making this documentary, because obviously, as we all know, Wendy did not win her run for governor in Texas. Greg Abbott won, and we've seen what he's done with the state. But in 2014, between 2014 and 2016, then I started, you know, making a bigger movie about voter education, voting rights, what gets people to turn out. And while making that documentary, while talking to active and eligible but not active voters, I realized that we could make a difference. And there's not a one-size-fits-all reason that people don't vote. There's a lot of different reasons. But education is a key piece that is missing in sustained voter turnout. And I really, from then, starting in 2016, I went back to school for my master's in political science, all while still working in television. And like loving my career in television, but also feeling like there was something bigger that I wanted to do and to be a part of.
Yeah. So as somebody that served in the legislature, what Wendy Davis did was really, really remarkable. And having, you know, watch stories and all the stuff that she had to do, even putting the catheter on under her dress so she wouldn't have to go to the bathroom. I mean, it was just like just amazing stuff. The closest I ever came to doing that was finding a bill that was like 100 pages long and making them have to read it out loud, right, to shut the process down. You know, so I appreciate people like that. And I appreciate, you know, folks taking a stand. And I could see how something like that would make somebody like, wow, now that's I want to get involved in politics. I want to do something. If this woman is going to take this kind of a stand, yeah, I want to be in a position to help her and help the cause and all that stuff. So I get it. Yeah. I get it. It was very inspiring. And even though I was out of the elected politics at that time, I was really, really rooting for her, and I'm glad that she was able to at least make a run for it. I hate that Greg Abbott won, and it is, you know, this show is not.
I mean, we're a nonpartisan organization. Right. We're really serious about being nonpartisan. But what I always say is, like, we run as a nonpartisan organization, but we don't want anybody to go to the polls, just close their eyes, and like pick who and what they're voting on, right? You need to care about something when you go to the polls. And so on all of our nonprofit social media channels, we're very serious about being nonpartisan, but it's not a secret to see how I feel about my own personal politics, because, you know,
yeah, and
he's,
so,
he's terrible.
Right.
He's awful.
And, you know, it's a whole nother conversation as to people like him and why he is what he is. But we're not here to talk about him. We're here to talk about you. So,
yeah, get out of here, Greg Abbott.
So this is a segue to go into explain what We Are Voters is.
We are a civics education first, nonpartisan voter turnout group. So we want to turn out voters. We want to increase voter turnout in a sustained way. And we want to see increase in turnout in every election, not just the presidential, not just the midterms. We want people to be turning out for their mayoral elections, their special elections, their school board elections, because, you know, as we know, I don't like to use the word smaller elections. There's no such thing as a small election. It all matters. The more local an election is, the larger impact it has on you as a person. We also know that the more local the election, the lower the turnout, which means that you are giving an increased amount of power to the very small amount of people that are actually going to turn out to vote. So we want to change that. We want to make sure that people are coming out for that and like feeling the power of their own vote and their own voice within their community. Stronger democracies build stronger communities, right?
That's exactly right.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. And so that go into that a little bit, to define a sustainable community building, and just, you know, put it in words what that actually means and what that actually looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're still in our building stage. So we are very open to the idea that what we're building right now, if it doesn't work, that's okay. There's no, you know, egos here. Then we need to go back to the drawing board, because we are committed to building out these really strong communities of voters. But what we're doing is we want to empower leaders in the community, people that want to turn out voters, that want to turn out their friends and family, that want to turn out their neighbors, their sports team, playmates, all that kind of stuff. We want to empower them and teach them what it means to turn out voters in all elections. So that comes from everything to teaching them literally what are the elections that are coming up in their area, what are the laws surrounding voting in their area, and also how do you talk to your friends and family about voting while being able to stay friends afterwards, which is a difficult thing, especially right now, right? So we're doing training programs. We're building out training programs to teach people how to do this and throw their own events, with the idea being that they are there in their community. I live in Los Angeles. So if somebody wants to do an event in, say, Fort Worth, Texas, I'm not going to be able to be out there constantly. I could be out there for an event, maybe, but they're not going to see me in the grocery store and be able to ask, hey, I have a question. We have an election coming up next week. How do I check my voter registration? They're not going to be able to see me to do that, but they are going to see another community leader. And they're going to remember, oh, that's right. I need to make sure that I am prepared to go vote this weekend.
So how many states have you established connections in?
Well, we have a board kind of placed all over the country, right? So we've got people in Michigan, in Chicago, in Florida, in Indiana, Arizona, and California. So we are going to try and build out programming there to start with. And then probably just based on my history in the state, my knowledge of politics in the state, probably Texas as well. And then we'll build out from there.
Yeah, because Chicago is important to me. That's where I grew up.
Nice.
And our political efficacy in Chicago is a little different. Well, at least it was when I was growing up. And it'd be interesting to kind of hear somebody that's doing that grassroots work, what their feel of it is. I tell this story a lot, you know, that my precinct captain was my little league coach. You know, so it's like that's how entrenched people were in politics, even at an early age. Right. So, you know, I know things have changed over the last 40 years or so. So I'm just kind of wondering, I mean, we see a guy like Brandon Johnson get elected mayor. But what does that really feel like? And what was the conversations? You know what I'm saying? Like with the Harold Washington thing, that was the first person I got to vote for. And, you know, it was a trendy thing. It was like, you know, it was a fashion statement to wear his campaign button. You know, it was a total buy-in in the community. And so, you know, I know things have evolved and have gotten more cynical since then, but I'd be curious to kind of hear what the feel is with the people in Chicago and how they're, you know, how they're organizing and all that. And then the other, a state that I would really love to see your group get into would be Mississippi. I think that is open, fertile ground for any organization about voter empowerment. And I just think about, you know, 60 years ago with SNCC and all the work that they did, and a lot of those folks who came from other parts of the country decided to live in Mississippi because of the work they had done, and to watch it come to fruition, to actually get to see Black elected officials at various levels in the state over that time period. So that's just my personal wish list. That's why I was asking.
All right, we'll take it. what's important for us too is that we don't want to. We want to be a value add for organizations that might already be in the area. We don't want to come in. First of all, we're new, but also, you know, it's important to us that we're making a positive impact. So we don't want to come in and just like steamroll work that's already been done or is already being done. We want to be a value add. Maybe organizations are already doing great turnout efforts, but they don't have the education resources. Let's help with that. Let's partner up together. I think it makes it easier to do the work, right? We can all work together because we have the same goal.
Right. Right. And that's an excellent mindset because, you know, that. So another hat I used to wear was ACLU. Right. I used to be a director of policy in Mississippi. And one of the things that we were trying to push some legislation to create a actual Mississippi Civil Rights Act, as opposed to just relying on the federal. And, you know, in trying to get younger people in or more grassroots organizations into the meetings, I just basically had to explain to them. And I use sports analogies a lot. And so I said, you remember this guy named Peyton Manning and how great a quarterback he was? And he had won a Super Bowl at the height of his powers. But then near the end of his career, he won another Super Bowl. And the reason why he won that Super Bowl that year was because he had the best defense in the league. So, you know, so it's like the other team wasn't going to score any points. So whatever he was able to do, they would win. And so I said, you need to look at groups like the ACLU and the NAACP and these older SPLC, all these older established groups as the Peyton Mannings. And y'all are the new defense. Y'all are the guys coming in that's going to bring the new energy and give these old organizations just one more shot at doing something constructive for the people. So, you know, and that buy-in worked. And we had a big coalition of folks working on this particular piece of legislation. It didn't pass because of the climate, but it was good to see people that had been like literally folks that rode on the freedom buses working with a younger generation of people to accomplish a goal. And I think that kind of mindset of coming in to assist instead of coming in to say, okay, we're here. Y'all fall back. We got this. You know what I'm saying? I think that's a great approach to do stuff.
I think it also, you know, going off of football again, it all moves the ball forward, right? Listen, I don't know that much about football. That's the extent of it. I know that there is a ball that has to go. I know other sports, but we could talk baseball.
Okay.
You got to move the ball forward no matter what, right? So when you're, even if something doesn't pass, who knows what good was done by teaming up somebody who's new in the space with somebody who literally was there from the very beginning and can tell incredible stories and teach them something. You don't know what kind of impact you're making and how far you're moving that ball forward, right?
Right. And it, you know, and just as a side note, and then we'll get into something else, but it was like we had to educate when we were talking about issues dealing with the trans community. There were some terms that this freedom rider who, you know, for all the time I had known this person, had always kind of kept up with what was going on. But there were some terms. He was like, Eric, what does that mean? So I was like going... Wow. So, you know, in my mind, I said, if people like this who have been in tune don't know, then we've got to enhance our education piece. So that's education is very, very important. We can't take for granted that people, you know. You know what I'm saying? That no matter how enlightened or exposed they may have been, there are some things that people don't know and they haven't been exposed to. And so it's always good to have that.
I agree.
So I want to get into one of your 9 verticals, right? Because that's something that you put in your mission statement on the website. The one that intrigued me was elevate political debates. So give me your ideal debate scenario. What would a effective, informative political debate look like?
Well, it would be calm, first of all. you know, it's tricky because there are some things that are not up for debate, right? A person's humanity is not up for debate. So you have to come into it with some like understanding. But I think the idea, what we want to do is be able to have conversations. If we're talking about, let's give a super basic this example. If you and I both want to increase a child's education. And the way that I think we will make better students is by eliminating homework. And the way that you think we can make better students is by tacking 3 weeks onto the school year. These are two way different things, but we have the same end goal, right? And if we can come to that and say, like, we both want to create a better education system for these students. So let's figure out, why do you say 3 weeks? Why do I say no homework? And how can we figure out what the basis of that is and get to it, because we both have the same reasonable goal. So that's got to be part of it too. And then the other thing is, like, I don't necessarily need to change your mind, but I would like you to consider my idea. You know what I mean? Just like have like a little bit of respect. And like I said, like, not everything is going to be up for debate. Somebody's humanity, their right to be safe in this world, in this country, to have access to rights, that's not up for debate. But if we can have the same basic goal, even if we're putting it two different ways, it's possible that we will come out at the end with like better students, right? That's kind of what we're looking for a little bit, but it's tricky.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. I think that, you know, the problem has been trying to accommodate, right? I would, you know, when you've got like 20 people running for president, for example, and then you're trying to create this criteria where all of them or most of them can be on the stage, you know, and people saying, well, it's not fair. Cause look, if your campaign can't even generate 1% of the vote, then nobody wants to hear what you have to say. It's like you're out of the conversation, right? This is not participation in politics. This is, I mean, you've got to be, if you're running for an office, you have to be competitive, right? Now, if it's just you and one other person, which, you know, the general elections kind of create those dynamics, then I would love to like just have, you know, debates about one or two particular issues. One of the best things I saw, there's this group called NACA, which is a housing initiative organization in Atlanta. They're national, but they're based out of Atlanta. And so what they did was there was a mayoral election in the city. This is the one where Keisha Lance Bottoms eventually won. So it was a bunch of people running. A lot of people didn't know that there was like 11 people running in that race. So they NACA had the idea that they would tie one of their workshops in with a debate with the mayoral candidates about housing.
Okay.
So their thing was they had to find a venue big enough to host the debate and the workshop. So they chose Ebenezer Baptist Church. This was just before Senator Warnock got elected. He's still the senior pastor there, but he was just the senior pastor there at that point. And so they were going to do it at Ebenezer. And so part of the criteria for the people attending the workshop is that if you want to get to the part where you can get a house, you got to sit through to the debate. Right. So it was packed. It was like wall to wall people at the church. The other criteria that NACA said was every person that is on the ballot has to show up. They have to be there. So there was a kid that was running, that was a student at Georgia Tech that nobody had seen, and he was there. And so, you know, so it was all 11 were there, and all they talked about was housing issues. They didn't get into anything else. It was just strictly, what are you going to do as the mayor to address these particular housing concerns? And the people, you know, were very pleased with that. I mean, people, I could hear people, you know, just talking among themselves about stuff. And they were asking questions like, well, is this going to impact all this stuff that I'm going to be doing in the next hour? You know what I'm saying? As a, what you want to do. So that's, to me, that's even with a crowd, there's a way that you can do stuff where people can get something out of it. And I wish we could have the debates like the James Baldwin versus William F. Buckley things. You know, I don't know in this day and age with that work, but I'm an old PBS firing line kind of guy. So I romanticize about that, but I don't know if we'll ever get back to that point.
I mean, I want a West Wing style debate. Like, but it's frustrating too. Because, you know, we look at like, let's look at the Republican primary debate that's coming up. That's not, there's so many candidates. So nobody's going to have an actual moment to say something. And also, is the moderator going to push back and say, that's not accurate? That never happens in debates. That's just the debate that's coming up next. But that never happens in any debate. Rarely happens in these debates. The biggest things to come out of the debates that people remember are like, yeah, a fly landed on Mike Pence's head, and then that was the moment of the debate. That's funny, but that's not what the purposes of these debates are. And when you're talking about so many people being on the stage, it's like, yeah, if you've only raised $1.1 million, but you have incredible name recognition as the former vice president, but you can only raise $1.1 million, you're not a serious candidate. So we're wasting other people's time to have you on the stage if you're not a serious candidate at this point.
Right. I agree. So, but we'll let them.
We deserve better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of the reason why we're in the situation we're in is because we've cheapened and tried to make intellectual exercises entertaining instead of letting the intellectual exercise be stimulating enough, right?
Yeah. But let politics be boring. You know? And we're entering into like not a great time. What is about to be not a great time? Speaking of like let politics be boring. You know, I say it as like a joke, but I mean it. It was better when it was boring, frankly. But now we have a writers and actors strike happening at the same time that is expected to go for a very long time, and people are going to turn to things like politics for their entertainment, and that's not good for anybody.
No.
Pay the actors and writers and let them get back to work so that, you know, we can let politics maybe be a little more boring.
And hopefully, you know, maybe you and maybe somebody else like can come back and talk about the particulars of that strike. Because I think a lot of people, their initial reaction is just like when the athletes go on strike. It's like, y'all making all this money. What y'all going on strike for? You know what I'm saying? So people need to.
I'm happy to have that conversation. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. So let's try to close this out, because I want to get in this one question that I think is really, really important, and allow people to know how to get in touch with you. So what do you think is the most pressing challenges, or what do you think is the most pressing challenge to the work you are doing right now? What is the biggest obstacle that you have to navigate?
We have two right now, to be blunt, money. We always, you know, that's the plight of a nonprofit, right? It's always coming up for, we need money. So your tax deductible donations are always very, very, they're put to work immediately. But the other thing is that just reminding people that their vote matters, that it matters that they are paying attention, and it matters that they get involved. Right now, there are a lot of people that want to tell voters that they should not vote. And they do that by trying to tell them that an election that was not stolen was stolen, that an election that did not have fraud by voters had so much fraud by voters that your vote doesn't even matter. And they try and tell them that their vote doesn't matter by creating laws that make it harder for them to vote. And what we want people to understand is that none of that happens. None of that happens if their vote actually wasn't incredibly important. And so trying to combat that is difficult. But we're doing our best, because it really matters. It matters that people get involved. It matters that people understand the incredible, awe-striking power of their vote in every single election.
So Michael Steele, then they asked him about voting and all these laws and attempts to try to curb Black people from voting. He said the best strategy was to overwhelm them. It's just, no matter what the restrictions, no matter what they're trying to do, show up and vote anyway. Do you agree that the overwhelming strategy is the best strategy?
Absolutely. Now, with the caveat that I live in California. I'm a white woman that lives in California. So it is so easy for me to say, yeah, absolutely, that's a strategy. Get out there and vote. Because it's really easy to vote in California, period, full stop. It's specifically easy to vote in Los Angeles. And it's also, for me as a white woman, pretty easy for me to vote wherever I live. Because, you know, since 1919, the laws have been written to make sure that I am included in the process. So it's pretty easy for me to say that. So the caveat being that it's harder to vote in places. They are making it hard to vote so that you don't vote. So if there is an organization that you are aware of in your state, in your county, in your community that wants to help you circumvent those laws and make sure that you can cast your ballot because you are eligible to do so, then you should reach out to those groups. We can also help you with that as well, because we recognize that there are laws being written to make sure that it is harder to vote. Absolutely, though, I agree. The best way through it is through it.
So you said that you're willing to help, and you said that you need some money. How can people get in touch with your organization?
They can reach out to us at wearevoters.org. That is our website. And then on all social media channels, we are wearevoters.org.
All right.
We try and make it as easy as possible. Our DMs are open, in a way that is normal. Just reach out to us. reach out to us.
All right. Well, yeah. Kib, I greatly appreciate you taking the time out, not only to do this podcast interview, but to focus your energy on doing something that is vital to maintain our democracy and to lift this country up and move it forward. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys. And we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So I hope that you were encouraged by Miss Moffitt and her story and why she has gotten involved in politics the way she is. And I hope that you go to the website, wearevoters.org, and, you know, like I need some Mississippi folks to reach out to her. I need some Mississippi folks to reach out to her, to get that going, because, you know, anywhere in the United States, it's important that people have a basic education about politics and understanding that every election is important. I know all the attention goes to the presidency, and you've heard me say that before. But the most important election may be your city council person, or as been proven with what's been going on in Florida and other places, your school board, right? So you need to be educated about that. So please reach out to Ms. Moffitt. Now, I want to get this brother on, and he is Rob Eshman. Rob is a writer, scholar, filmmaker, and educator from Chicago. So you already know he's got to go at all these from the Chi, right? He is also an associate professor of social work and a member of the Data Science Institute at Columbia University, as well as a faculty associate of Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. And so I have him on because he's written a book called When the Hood Comes Off. And he talks about racism in this age of technology that we're dealing with. So without any further ado, I want to bring on as a guest, and I am honored to have as a guest on this podcast, Mr. Rob Eshman. All right, Professor Rob Eshman, how you doing, brother? You doing good?
Doing well. And sorry to, you know, and I don't know if this is an issue. It's Rob Eshman.
It's Eshman. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm glad we got that straightened out, because I hate to be calling you by the wrong name. My name is Fleming, but they always add an S to it. You know, some of our folks down here in the South. And speaking about that, so you're from Chicago originally, right?
I am, born and raised.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Northside College Prep.
Okay.
Chicago Public School High School. It's a magnet school on the north side.
Okay. I went to Lindblom, which is now a math and science academy, but it was Lindblom Tech when I went there. So I'll be up there, Lord willing, next month for my 40th high school reunion.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. You know, I applaud that. I haven't been back to any of my high school reunions, so it's something I would love to do. I just haven't had the chance yet.
Yeah, man, take advantage of that. It's just it's really something, man. I went to Garrett Morgan for elementary school, and they've closed that down. So we had a 40th reunion for that. Everybody just kind of thought it'd be good, and we had it over there at the park because it was over there. It's not that far from Simeon, where that school is. But anyway, enough about memory lane. Let's get you all to pick your brain. You've written this book called When the Hood Comes Off. So a lot of my questions are going to be based off of the book. But one of the things I like to do is, if I can find a quote that is related to the work of the guest or a direct quote from that guest or whatever, I throw it back at them. so I can get a response. So your quote is, "But there are none so frightened or so strange in their fear as conquerors. They conjure phantoms endlessly, terrified that their victims will someday do back what was done to them, even if, in truth, their victims couldn't care less about such pettiness and have moved on. Conquerors live in dread of the day when they are shown to be not superior, but simply lucky." What does that quote mean to you?
You know, so that is actually a quote from N.K. Jemisin's series, the Broken Earth Trilogy. So N.K. Jemisin is a Black woman who won Best Fantasy Book in a year, 3 years in a row. And this, you know, and I love that series, and the quote comes from that. And it's interesting, the quote is not talking about race in the way that we think about it. But I took it and I use it as an introduction to a chapter where I talk about masked racism, or racism that is hidden, racism that is embedded in systems and interactions, but it's not, you know, something that is overt that everyone can recognize, that people, you know, that most of the time racism is there, but not everyone sees how it's working. And, you know, so I use that quote to introduce the chapter, just as we think about the creation of this very insidious, invisible, right, durable system of racism that seeks to maintain power for a few folks, for maintain white supremacy. And so for me, that quote refers to the way that, you know, that racial inequality has, and, you know, this is something that has been intentional. Racial domination has been an intentional project by folks seeking to maintain power, and it continues to be intentional. And I think that when we see some of the things that are going on now in the world, from books being banned in Florida to the decisions in the Supreme Court, that you see folks in power, white folks who are legitimately, or, you know, at least in their rhetoric, scared of people of color taking what they have, taking their power and their privileges, and then they're making laws accordingly to try and maintain power. And so I think that's something that quote points out. And it also highlights, right, the way that, right, when you think about conquerors, they're scared of being treated the way that they've treated others. And there's this assumption that, right, that if things are equal, it means they will be, you know, they will be oppressed. There is no, right, they have no conception of what it might mean to have a equality in a system without oppression. They feel like if they are not doing the oppressing, then that means that they are going to be oppressed.
So there's a couple of words that kind of struck me. Well, one word we've been dealing with all our lives, but it was another word in there that kind of struck me. So I'm going to get you to explain that one. But I want to ask a basic question. Give me your definition of racism.
Racism is, and, you know, ideas or behaviors, that, but, you know, right. So the way that I define it in the book is I talk about, racism as being not just an idea, not just prejudice, but it's an idea about racial, you know, inferiority or inequality that legitimates or justifies systems of racial domination. And so the central to this, you know, definition is this notion that racism is not just an ideology. It's not just the way that people think about racial differences. It's also the effects of that ideology. And so this is why people can be racist unintentionally. If they hold on to ideas that, you know, reinforce racial inequality, then that is a racist idea, whether or not that idea is rooted in hate.
So based on that definition, can people of color be racist?
You know, I think that when people say folks of color cannot be racist, they're typically referring to this notion of power dynamics, that for folks of color who may be, you know, who may have hold prejudice, they can't be racist because they are not in power and reproducing racism for another group. And I think, you know, that is where that idea comes from for most people. But I think that, you know, there's something called internalized racism, and I do think that folks of color can internalize racist ideas that originated in white supremacy, but that now they are holding on to ideas that are reinforcing the, you know, the oppression of their own people or of other groups of color. So yes, I do think that, folks of color can be racist, even though I do want to, you know, point out that that most of the time when people are saying that black folks can't be racist, they're saying that we don't use the term racist to refer to black folks having some kind of a prejudiced idea about white folks, because racism is a structural level problem, and that kind of reverse racism is a myth, because black people do not run the world in a way where they can, you know, reinforce a system of domination against white people. Right. So in that sense, right, I want to point out that is where when people say, oh, no, black folks can't be racist to white folks, that is what they're talking about, is that to be racist to someone is to subordinate them. And black people do not have the power to subordinate white people. Therefore, right, we would not use the term racist to refer to, you know, kind of black prejudice or stereotypes towards white folks.
Right. And that was, you know, in my training, that's the way that I understood it, that it was like, you know, people can have prejudices and people can have dislikes. But it's when you talk about racism, especially here in America, and I guess you can apply it to other parts of the world too, but in America, it's all about the system, about being able to use race as a leverage point to subjugate somebody else, right? So when white people accuse people of color of being racist, do they use the same standard as they would in identifying a white person as a racist?
I believe so. And I think that the way that most people define racist is as someone who is openly white supremacist, someone who, you know, says or does something that is overtly and openly discriminatory. And so I think that when, right, white folks are claiming reverse racism, it can, right, it's usually talking about someone who says something, right? If you say white people are this, then they will say that's racist. And they would only label white racism as being a white person saying black people are bad, right? And so it's kind of the simplistic understanding of racism that can lead to a misunderstanding of right, what is reverse racism. For example, this idea that affirmative action is reverse racism and that white folks are somehow discriminated against by this policy, right? This is a anti-racist policy that was designed in order to, you know, account for the ways that white privilege has operated historically and is operating now. And the idea that this reverse racism shows, right, that this is an individual level analysis that is not taking into account structure or history, right, the system of privileges that we have in society. And so it's when you have a very simplistic definition of racism, that is when you can, you know, start to buy into the reverse racism myth.
And since you alluded to that, you know, I probably want to pick your brain maybe a little later, either later on this year or next year, to kind of see how that Supreme Court decision affects, you know, the school that you teach at. And see if you notice some kind of a difference, or as you talk with faculty and other folks, to see how that goes. Since you brought it up, so if you're willing to do that, I would love to have you to come back on to talk about that. But the reason why I asked that question is in the book you talk about how white people, you know, will say a David Duke is racist, right? Because he comes out and says all these things, and, you know, he literally has worn the hood and the robe, you know what I'm saying, to political functions, and being a leader of the Klan at one point in Louisiana. So a white person will say that person is racist, but you talked about how when they tried to put Donald Trump in a corner, like in the presidential debate, when he said that infamous line to the Proud Boys, you know, stand back and stand by, they pressed him, but he didn't come out and say that he was racist. Matter of fact, he said the opposite. I'm the least racist person in the room. And in the book, you kind of depict white folks as saying, okay, well, if he says he's not racist, then he's not racist. And that's the standard. So that was the reason why I asked the question, because it's like you position it where it's like, in order for a white person to acknowledge that another white person is racist, that they have to just be out in the open with it. And then, you know, never mind the policies that they push. It's like, if they say they're not racist, then white folks give them the benefit of the doubt.
Exactly. And I think that, right, that many folks see racism as being something that if you don't admit it, we can't prove that that is who you are. If we don't catch you in something, if there's not some kind of a leaked video showing you use the N-word, if you don't claim proudly, yes, I'm a white supremacist and I'm going to march with a tiki torch at the next Proud Boys rally, then, you know, people will hold back in calling you a racist. And I think that, right, that comes from this notion that many people see racism as being what I call in the book, racism with a capital R, or racist with a capital R, where you are an open white supremacist who you are proud of your beliefs, you're proud of your hate, and you want other people to hate just like you do. But that is not what racism looks like nowadays. I think, right, one of the things I talk about in the When the Hood Comes Off is in the years since the, you know, classic civil rights movement, white folks have stopped admitting that they are racist, you know, not just interpersonally in public or mainstream settings, but then on surveys and research. And so researchers have had to find creative ways to measure racism in a world where people don't want to tell you that they're racist. But if we understand that people don't tell us when they're racist anymore, then we can't, right? We have to also allow our definition of racism to change, where we can't just measure racism, or we can't just decide things are racist when people admit it. Because we're in a world where policies don't say that they're racist on a surface level, but they have racist impacts, that they disproportionately impact folks of color, whether we're talking about housing policies, criminal justice policies, education policies. And so where we have to be able to point out when and where, how racism works, even when racism is not explicitly the law of the land.
Right. And I love the how this, you go through the steps of how surveyors have had to be creative. Pollsters have had to be creative in trying to gauge people. But the one that kind of hit home with me with my law enforcement background was how many milliseconds it would take for a white officer to draw a gun on a white perp with a gun, as opposed to a black perp with a gun. Mm-hmm. You know, and people are using that now as a measurement to determine, yeah, that person's got racial bias based on how they react to a situation like that. So I'm glad that you enumerated that in the book. The other term I wanted to get to is disinhibition. Explain that term to the listeners.
Yeah, so one of the, right, part one of the book, When the Hood Comes Off, I talk about the ways that racism has been masked, ways that it's been hidden, and how, right, the characteristics of online communication that can unmask racism, that can reveal racism's face, and they can help people see racism where they may not have seen it before. And one of the characteristics of online communication that I talk about is called the online disinhibition effect. And what this refers to is just the way that human beings online, when we're talking with people without looking them in the face, without having this eye contact, we tend to get more hostile in those interactions. And that hostility is not limited to just talking about race. But of course, when you bring race into the conversation, things get ugly. But the online disinhibition effect refers to the way that people tend to be more hostile with each other online. They say things in ways that they wouldn't say them in person because they feel disconnected from social norms that keep us friendly in our everyday interactions. They feel disconnected from consequences of their actions, right? That you can say whatever you want and you won't get punched in the face, or you may not lose a friend because you're using an anonymous username, not your real name, right? And because of those things, you know, conversations online can become more harsh. And what happens is when we bring racial discussions into the mix, people begin to reveal old-fashioned racist with a capital R ideas and ideologies more so than we typically experience in our jobs and in our schools in mainstream settings, right? And this can be an eye-opening experience. And that's one of the things I explore in the book, is that how do folks of color react and interpret increased open racism that they see online. And I find that one of the things it can do is open people's eyes to the way that racism is still alive, not just through the racist with a capital R, you know, examples of racism, but also the ways that it's hidden. And that the unmasking of racism online can cause us to have a different lens for viewing the world, and we can begin to seek an understanding of how racism is hidden and how it works.
And I love the way that you personalize that in the book. So I want people to get the book. So I'm not going to tell you how he did it or what the story was, but I really appreciated how you brought it home so that people can relate. It's like, oh yeah, well that happened to me, you know? You know, it's just, it, because a lot of time we get detached from stuff, and you kind of, address that. So let me, this is the way I wrote the question, and it's kind of long, but I'm gonna do it, 'cause I think there's a point. You basically say that racism is hidden behind the metaphorical hood of subtlety in the post Jim Crow era. However, since the emergence of Donald Trump in American politics, we have seen a resurgence in explicit expressions of racism. You further argue that people don't know how to combat racism because we have focused on mass racism, such as microaggressions, for so long. Now, I would counter and say that we don't have, nor have we ever had, the collective will to properly combat racism. How do you respond to somebody like me that's like, look, racism ain't never gone away. If white folks wanted to deal with it, they would have dealt with it. They would have fixed it. So my thing is, you know, they're not shocked. They're not. It's like, oh, okay, now we can kind of, some of them are like, okay, now we can express ourselves a little freely because we've been trying to behave these last 40, 50, 60 years. You know what I'm saying? So that's my attitude. It's like, how do you counter when you run into somebody like me that has that kind of opinion?
Can you kind of restate the opinion that you're saying here? You want me to counter?
I'm saying, I believe that white folks have never had the collective will to end racism, period. Mm-hmm. So just now that it's come out in the open is just because it's been festering for all these years. And now they feel they have a window of opportunity to express themselves instead of it being like, well, you know, we've been just dealing with the microaggressions. We'll just deal with the implicit bias stuff. But you know, and so now that racism has come back out in full force again, you make the argument in the book that folks don't know how to handle that, at least liberal white folks. And I say that it doesn't matter, liberal, conservative, whatever, white folks, if they wanted to end racism, they would have ended it. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to say a couple things in response to that. So one is that there are different interpretations for this kind of resurgence of open racism. And so some people, right, just the way, and you know, one way we can understand this is think about the different interpretations people had of racism seeming to disappear. When you have surveys being sent out asking people, are you racist? Are you racist? And people used to be comfortable saying yes, and then they stopped being comfortable saying yes. And do we interpret that as meaning that racism has died, or does that mean that people are just uncomfortable telling us how they really feel? And the example, right, the answer could be both. I think that, right, that some explicitly racist ideas probably have decreased. I think less people now than in the 1940s believe that Black folks are biologically inferior, right? That may be an idea that has gone away. But that does not mean that racism is any less powerful now than it was in the 1940s. It means that it has changed. And I think that the reality is racism can be maintained without them hating us. They don't need to hate us in order to, right? Like, what is racism? This comes from a capitalist project to dominate because you want resources. So folks don't have to hate us in order to, right? All they have to do is want their own personal best interest. And just acting in that way can reproduce racist systems. The racism is set up right now in such a way that white folks do not need to hate us in order to keep us subjugated. They don't need to hate us in order to say, look, I like the police because the police are protecting us, right? And so that idea does not mean that they are anti-black. It means that they don't understand how the over-policing in black communities and, you know, unequal sentencing being handed down leads to our disproportionately being in prison. So you can have people who don't hate black folks who are in support of policies that keep black folks down. At the same time, I think that what I'm hearing you say, right, or part of what I'm hearing you say is that, yeah, I do think that there are people who have been explicitly racist the whole time, who have just been holding it in. And now they feel like they have gained a space, both online and in person, and right, where they can be a little bit more open with those ideas. And I think that's what Trump did, is he took the type of language that was normal on Twitter and brought it to the mainstream by speaking that same way in his political campaigns. His policies were not very different than from other Republican policies, but his rhetoric was. He was more brash, right? When it came to more coarse with his language when it came to talking about things of race or gender differences, right? And that, right? Whereas most Republicans would choose to hide their racism and, you know, with dog whistles and then, you know, using political language that let people know, hey, this is the racist team, but we're not allowed to say those things. Trump proved that there you can still be popular even when you're a little bit more explicit with that, which we're seeing now with that, right? There are other folks who have kind of taken up his style of being in Congress, right? That they feel like their donations will go up when they make headlines for something that many of us would see as being problematic. And yes, I do think that, right, if white folks wanted to, they could have gotten rid of this problem. But at the core of that is that, you know, people do what is in their best interest to do. And for folks who, right, have unearned privileges, it's easier for them to argue that those privileges were not unearned than it is for them to give up those privileges to help other people. Right. So look at something like reparations. It's difficult to imagine folks wanting to give away money for reparations for a problem they believe happened so long ago that they are not culpable. Right. It's difficult for white folks to understand the way that their privileges now are based on the actual measurable material advantages that were given, a few generations ago. And because of that, right, being told that now we need you to give up something. And so I think that they're right, that it is absolutely right that this is a problem that it comes from both the right and the left. Whether you're liberal or conservative, you can be a part of the racial inequality problem. Yeah, I think that right, that there are different ways that people interpret this kind of this unmasking of racism. And I think that that's something that, you know, in the book, I talk about different ways that the black folks and folks of color have responded to racism becoming more visible online. For some folks, it's proof. For other folks, it changes their minds. For other folks, it becomes a tool that they want to use in order to show, you know, other people in their circle, hey, this is how racism works. Here's the proof that I've been talking about.
And so since your book does deal a lot with the digital aspect of racism, let me direct my questions toward that. So are there certain video games or social media platforms more prone to elicit racist remarks more than others?
You know, I talk about racism in video games. And I think when I was coming up and playing a lot of video games, it was everywhere. It was every game. And it's a lot less common now. I think that, you still can hear it, but it's right. Like now there are reporting mechanisms where people are using too much abusive language. They're going to get banned temporarily or permanently. So I think that, right, it's less now where, right, I wish I had more time to play video games, but I don't get to play the way I used to. And so, but what I understand from my kids is that it is a lot less common now than it used to be. But then I also, right, there are also ways now for parents and things that I do to set up where you don't have conversations with the public, where my kids can only hear the voices of their friends when they're playing video games online, so that they don't have the opportunity to get called the N-word the way that I did when I was playing video games. So they're right there. Protections in place. There is more moderation. I think on social media sites, most social media sites these days have kind of the basic, rather they don't like hate speech. They don't like speech that incites violence. I think Twitter has pulled back a little bit of what they were doing. I think that Elon has somewhat of a different idea. But you know, the N word was getting thrown around on Twitter before Elon took over too. I think that the people find ways to use racist language online in unmoderated spaces. I think that the bigger a social media platform gets, the more its moderation policies develop. But then you also have forums that are dedicated to, you know, being safe havens for racist speech. And then those may be places where you find more of the recruiting of white supremacists, online.
Yeah. And then, you know, this podcast might be dated because we're referring to it as Twitter, and it may be called X by the time this comes out. I don't know. That's a whole bizarre saga. I just can't wait for the book on that one.
We'll see. I think that they're saying they're going to keep the name Twitter, but the company will be called X. But then there, I also saw something saying that maybe some other companies own the rights to the word X. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think Zuckerberg's involved in that lawsuit too. So let me ask you this question. Does the internet shape the way people talk about race, or do people talking about race shape the internet?
I think both of those can be true, that the internet absolutely shapes the way people talk about race in multiple directions, right? So I talked about how the first part of the book is where I am showing how does the internet change the way people talk about racism or express racism. And we know that online, you know, many people are more comfortable being open with their racism than they would be in face-to-face situations. But the second half of the book, right, the title of the book is When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age. The second half of the book focuses on resistance and how, you know, folks of color and white folks who are resisting racism are using digital tools in order to challenge racism in everyday interactions and conversation. And what we find is that, right, while, the most common way to respond to a microaggression, according to the research, is to not respond, online responses to microaggressions and racism is much more common for, you know, a variety of reasons. That people have more time to sit down and think about how they want to respond and type out a response. That people don't feel like their lives, they're not in danger of physical harm by challenging racism. That they're right, that there are fewer repercussions. That there's less individual level pressure on people to respond because there's a community of people who see this problematic content or comment, and then they can decide to start typing to point out why that is not going to be acceptable in this Facebook group or, you know, wherever it may be on the right, whether it's in a, you know, it could be a comment on a news article. And so I think that what we see, right, not only is racism more explicit online, but resistance is more common, and people feel more empowered to resist online than they do in person many times.
Right. So I've had a guest on this podcast. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Sheena Mason, but she has she's gotten her doctoral thesis on the theory of racelessness, right? So she's advocating an end for racial classification. How do you feel that will change American society going forward if we stop using racial terms?
I don't see that being good. I think that is that's kind of an example of colorblindness and people believing that if we don't talk about color, that racial inequality will go away. But if we stop using racial classifications, all that will mean is that people won't be able to know when there's racism, right? If we don't, right? So an example of this is one of the things I talk about in the book is going to a presentation of a scholar who had research on the effects of police violence on mental health. And they were using data that they got from the police, but they did not have race as a variable. And when I asked why, they said it's because the police department did not give them data on race. So the police department would, right, was okay giving data on violence and mental health, but they did not want us, right? They did not want the researcher to have that data on race. Now, what happens when we don't have data on race? We are unable to tell you when this is a problem that is focused on specific racial groups. And if we are not looking at race as a variable, then that means we will begin to have a racial, you know, right? There's going to be a black underclass, and there will be no data to point out that there is some kind of racist policy that is having a racist impact where black folks are disproportionately, you know, affected. And so I think that it's a, you know, it's a type of thing that, like, in a, if you're writing science fiction, would it be great to have a society one day where, you know, things are so egalitarian that you don't need to measure race and that the human race is just the human race? You know, like, you know, maybe if you're in a Star Wars land and they're right, we're living amongst groups of aliens. And so, right, you know, racial differences amongst humans are not seen as being a real, you know, a real difference as much as they are a difference between the humans and the you know, the reptile aliens or whatever it may be. But in the real world, I know, right, you know, race impacts our life chances. Race impacts our networks. Race impacts our opportunities and our limitations. And if we stop measuring race because we want to believe that it doesn't exist, it is going to lead to greater inequality, and it is going to hurt the ability of activists and educators and scholars to understand and, you know, fight against, you know, what, you know, what racism may look like.
All right, so I'm gonna have to leave it there. That sounds like a show I can put together too. Brother Eichmann, just tell the folks how they can get a copy of the book, how they can get in touch with you, and all that good stuff.
Yeah. So the book, When the Hood Comes Off, is available online. You can order it at Amazon, Barnes and Noble. If you want to support, you know, your local bookstore, and it's not in stock, you can go ahead and tell them to order it for you if that's where you want to buy the books. So you can really get the book wherever books are sold. You can find me on my website, robeschman.com. I'm on Twitter, at Rob Eschman. I'm on Instagram at rob.eschman. And, you know, any of those places you can get in contact with me and, you know, continue to follow the work.
All right, Brother Eschman, thank you for correcting me again. I appreciate you coming on and talking about this. I appreciate the effort that you put in to hone in on something that's going to impact us for generations, because we are getting more and more digital and more technology based. And so, like you said, in science fiction, we wanted to believe that as we got more technologically advanced, that a lot of the problems that we're dealing with now socially would go away. But I'm glad that you have shown a light that we still got some work to do if we want to get there. So I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me. You know, this is a great conversation. And of course, I do look forward to coming back to chat more.
Yes, sir. All right, guys. And we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right. And so we're back. So I'm glad that Professor Eschman corrected me, because you heard me mispronounce his name a couple of times, even in the intro, right? And, you know, like I said, some of the side, he was a little concerned. I said, no, that's fine. You know, like I said, I'm not perfect. And, but I'm glad, you know, we got that straightened out. So it's Rob Eschman. And again, the name of the book is When the Hood Comes Off. Right. And, you know, a lot of people, one of the things I like about this age of writing, because the book is very cerebral as far as, you know, you can see the analytical mind working and how he breaks everything down, you know, goes step by step. But what I like about this age of writing is that people write as if they're talking to average people instead of, you know, fellow intellectuals, right? So this is it's an in-depth book, but it's a good read, and I encourage people to read it, because, you know, I don't claim to be an expert and know how many books are out there in this thing, but this was like one of the first books that I was hipped up to that talks about racism and technology, right, from a Black perspective. So, and if there's other books out there and y'all want to come on the podcast, please reach out to me and let me know, and I'll be honored to put you on and let my listeners have a chance to hear what you have to say. So we got that. But before I go, I want to hip y'all up to something. There's stuff that's been going on. I'm trying to play with some ideas about how I can, because I'm asking people to do the Patreon, and I know people have little hooks and all that, and maybe one of the things I need to do is set up something for subscribers where you get a daily take from me or something about something that happened in the news right then, instead of waiting for me to kind of summarize it in a week or on a day like this when I've got guests and I can't really riff for an hour or a half hour. You know, I just, maybe that's something I'll do. I don't know. I'm still trying to play with that, because I know people want something extra with the subscription, but again, if you subscribe, it just helps. It's going to help me keep this podcast going and take it to another level, right? Some of you may have seen my post. If you are a fellow podcaster, an African-American, a Black fellow podcaster, please submit your podcast to the Black Podcasting Awards. Just being nominated by that organization has meant a lot to me. Hopefully, you know, I can be in the running again. You know, this is, I think it's fourth year. So, you know, so I think to have people, cause they'll give you a scorecard, you know, once everything is done and all this stuff, cause the awards are actually in September. The deadline is July 31st. So if you, go ahead and submit your stuff. You know, you'll get professional people to grade it, and then they'll tell you, you know, like you need to improve your sound, or, you know, the content, whatever critique they will have, it'll be beneficial to you. And so that's the reason why I have guests, because that was one of the things that, you know, it was one thing for me to be, you know, having hot mic episodes, but, you know, one of the judges suggested that that would be a nice element if you can get people on to have a discussion about things other than just your opinion. So, you know, that's what I'm doing. So again, if you're a Black podcaster, please submit your stuff to the Black Podcast Awards. Even if you don't care about winning an award, it's a free critique of the content that you are doing. Well, I shouldn't say free. There's an application fee, but you can actually get reimbursed from that. But go to that website, go to the Black Podcasting Awards website. I think it's blackpodawards.org, and they'll tell you everything that you need to know. So that was one thing I wanted to say. The other thing I wanted to say is, if you live in the state of Ohio or you have friends in the state of Ohio. August the 8th is an election day. The only thing that's going to be on the ballot, I think, now, I don't know how they do municipal thing, but the only thing that's going to be on the ballot statewide is a referendum to change the voting thresholds on referendums. And judging, I may have more time to get into it, but here's the deal. So in November, Ohio is going to have a referendum dealing with abortion, right? And basically, Republicans in the state legislature know that they're going to lose. They're going to lose that vote. And the people of Ohio are going to vote for access to reproductive health care. What they decided to do was change the game. And so they literally called a special session to get this on the ballot in August to have a special election to change the threshold. So you're going to have to get at least 60%, maybe 66. I don't know. Somebody said a supermajority, which sounds like 2/3, right? But instead of the normal majority threshold for a referendum in Ohio, they're asking to change it to either 60% or 2/3 majority to have a referendum go into effect. I think it's 60. And so, for example, in November, if this passes, right, if this passes on August the 8th, then in November, if the majority of people vote for reproductive access, but it's only 59%, then it doesn't go into law, right? It doesn't go into the Constitution or whatever. It stops it. So, you know, but the ironic thing is that this referendum on August the 8th doesn't need a supermajority. And see, these are the days that I wish I was still a legislator. Because if I was a legislator in Ohio, and I hope that somebody did it, you know what I'm saying? But I would have offered an amendment right then and said, if we're asking for people from this point forward to have a referendum threshold, then this particular referendum needs to have that threshold, right? You know, you can't take advantage of the law and say, okay, well, we only needed 50 plus one to get this a law. And now from every referendum from this point on, it's got to be 2/3 or 60%. You know what I'm saying? That's hypocritical to me. But hypocrisy is, thy name is Republican, right? I mean, that's how they roll. You know what I'm saying? Anything to try to get an advantage against the will of the majority. So if you are in Ohio, I am asking you to vote no on the August 8th special election. First, I need you to go vote. I need people. I know people. And this is the reason why they planned in August, because they figured y'all are going to be going on trips and stuff, trying to get out of Cincinnati, get out of Toledo, get out of Cleveland, get out of Akron and go somewhere and enjoy summer vacation before school starts and all that stuff. That's why they did that. But whatever is going on, if you know you're going on vacation, get your absentee ballot ready. Or if you already got the plans, I get it. Get an absentee, go to your courthouse and get an absentee ballot now, right? But if you are going to be in the state of Ohio on August the 8th, I need you to vote no on this referendum. I need you to send a message that in a democracy, you live with the results, right? If you put your name out there to run for an office and you don't get the votes, you live with that. If you get the votes, do no harm when you govern, right? But I really need people to get the word out in Ohio and vote no on August the 8th. And again, if I've got time next show, I'll try to get a little more information on it. But I just wanted to make sure that that's out there now. There are groups out there that are organizing and knocking on doors and canvassing and doing what needs to be done to get that word out. But I really need y'all to, in Ohio, to pay attention, because again, folks are trying to slip one on us. And, you know, at some point in time, it would seem to me, and I said I wasn't going to do this, but at some time it seemed to be that instead of trying to figure out ways to stop people from voting so you can be in power, just do what the people ask you to do. Campaign on issues that people are wanting to deal with. Have a better solution than your opponent, right? And you might be surprised that people might vote for you. You know what I'm saying? They might vote for your party. But if your party is the only thing y'all trying to do is stop people from voting or minimize their voice, their effectiveness, yeah. You know, I would hate to, again, go back to this era of good feelings where there's only one relevant political party in the discussion and the other one is just out there to be out there. You know what I'm saying? This, you know, I don't know if we're ready to be like England and other countries where we have multiple parties, but we definitely need two. We need at least two to have a debate and have an intelligent discussion about the issues and hopefully select the right people to make the right decisions. Right? So, you know, when we get to a point again where we're actually having debates about issues instead of one-upping the other person, you know, we'll democracy will be healthy again, right? And once we have a healthy democracy, then a lot of this stuff that we're dealing with now, the racism, the economic inequality, all this stuff, we can have intelligent discussions about it and come up with some real solutions about it, right? And get fear out of the equation. Elections are not supposed to be about how scared you are. It's supposed to be about how hopeful you are, right? So again, vote no on August the 8th if you live in the state of Ohio. And until next time.